From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noah.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Dylan the Tennessee Pal Fagan. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. That makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. We are putting on our ridiculous history garb. In a way, and you know,
the robes, folks, our ridiculous robes,
our occulted Illumination Global Unlimited Ridiculous History branded robes, a lot of brand names there. And tonight we are exploring something that may be apropos to the current situation here in the United States and abroad: unions and governments. They've always had a complicated, at times antagonistic, violent series of interactions. And, you know, we live in different parts of the Atlanta metro area. We all know different people and get into different situations. So I'd like to begin tonight by asking you guys, do you see any, like, what's your vibe check in your neck of the woods on unions? What's the public opinion feeling like?
I can't speak for public opinion, but I would just say that juxtaposition of unions and governments is really interesting, because the middleman between those two powers is always private industry, right? So it's how much does, capital, how much does the government support, defend, or go against an organization that's making quite a lot of money, which reads tax dollars for a government?
Well, and it's also an interesting double-edged sword, because historically unions have sometimes gotten a bad rap because of the potential for corruption and, you know, things like Jimmy Hoffa and organized crime and Teamsters Union and all that stuff. And I think it gives a bad rap to an otherwise very, very positive institution. So I think some people have maybe a skewed perspective on what unions even are and what they're meant to accomplish because of some of these big flashy stories and movies and things.
Mm-hmm. Especially because your public history textbooks don't go too far out of their way to talk about the troubled history of labor in the United States.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And we're faced, and we have, humanity has been faced for a long time, especially in capitalist societies, with this problem of you need everybody to be consumers to the extent that they possibly can, right? Have enough money to buy all the stuff that's being produced. So how much do you actually pay the human beings that produce the stuff to keep those goods cheap?
It's a formula.
So that everybody can buy it. And, and it's this weird little game that's played. And unions generally stand there to say, hey, you need to pay the people who make the stuff enough money to afford the stuff.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, too, like, oftentimes if you don't have somebody standing up for you, or you aren't the one that's standing up for yourself or your industry, the people in charge of the industry are going to pay you as little as humanly possible to maximize those profits.
Yeah. And let's be clear on this aspect of it right now. Like, the public opinion waxes and wanes, especially over recent decades, but most people can agree that workers should have certain basic rights. You know, it's sad that it's distressingly common here in the United States for people to kind of assume that Labor Day is about maybe people giving birth instead of workers' rights. And I'm calling myself to account there, but for many years, a younger version, I was under that misapprehension. And many of the rights held by workers in the United States today come directly from the actions of unions, and no kidding, from those organizations fighting against very real conspiracies and more than a few times dying in pursuit of those ideas. And before we introduce this, Matt, I think there you cited here in the doc a statement that I think we all found moving, which is a great introduction to our specific topic this evening.
Oh yeah, it's almost a poem. written by Frank J. Hayes, who from 1917 until 1919 was the United Workers of America president. That is a union.
Which we'll get to, yeah, in depth, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to talk about him a little later. Well, I don't know how much we'll talk about him because he comes right after the events that we're going to be discussing today. But he had this to say about the subject that we're going to be discussing. In the embers, gray and red, here we found them, where they bled. Here we found them, stark and dead, here on Ludlow Field.
And this is one reason I really like this is because this also is a clear homage or an arguable homage to the famous war poem In Flanders Field.
Yes.
By John McCrae, written in 1915. And I believe Hayes said this just a few years after. So it's very much in the zeitgeist.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this brings us, what an excellent introduction to this entire forgotten. Keep it in, Dylan. Sorry. History of union activism and corruption and crime. Tonight's exploration hinges on one of the most infamous examples of what happens when this fraught relationship goes wrong. This is our episode on the Ludlow Massacre.
It's been 30 years since the horror began.
911, what's your emergency?
He said he was going to kill me.
3 decades since our small beach community was terrorized by a serial killer.
Maybe, my dear Courtney, we're not done after all.
In the 1990s, the tourist town of Domino Beach became the hunting ground of a monster. No one was safe. No one could stop it. Police spun their wheels. Politicians spun the truth, while fear gripped us tighter with every body that was found. We thought it was over. We thought the murders had ended. But what if we were wrong?
Come back to Domino Beach, Courtney. Come home. I'll be waiting for you.
Listen to The Murder Years, Season 2, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They stroll in like regular shoppers.
Did it ever occur to you that all these crazy shoplifting stories are actually connected?
The $8 million retail theft ring.
I'm going deep undercover.
It's hard to visualize you with hair.
To connect the dots and expose this secret world.
It's 100% human trafficking.
So you can make $1,000 a day shoplifting.
Yeah.
But she's just a worker bee. I actually confront the real shoplifting queen herself.
Just wanted to see if you'd be interested in talking to me about charges and stuff.
No, I have no comment.
A mother of three, orchestrating all her crimes from a secluded hilltop mansion.
We're walking around the perimeter of the house now. I hear the cops. Do you think we should go?
Let's roll.
We're running from the cops.
Listen to Queen of the Con Season 6, The California Girls, on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Gosh, if I was one of those California girls, I'd be sweating.
The nightmare of what happened to a family inside 999 North Rodeo Gulch Road on a perfectly ordinary afternoon, and the burning home a killer would leave behind, and the river of blood that police would find leading all the way to the deep end will stay with you for a long, long time. And it's just one of the homes waiting for you to enter on Season 3 of Murder Homes. So step inside to hear the story of a day that will always be frozen in time. Binge the full season of Murder Homes now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the back of your mind, you've always suspected there's something strange about reality. The Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast proves there is. All October, hosts Joe McCormick and Robert Lamb take a lighter look at the scary side of movies, history, and the occult.
This movie has both Christopher Lee and retinal optography.
That was the idea where you could look in a dead person's eyes and see the last thing they saw.
That's right, in this case, a dinosaur.
Listen to Stuff to Blow Your Mind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Save on family favorites at Safeway. This week at Safeway, get 18-count Lucerne cage-free eggs, large, grade AA, for only $3.47 each with digital coupon limit one. Plus, get mega packs of bone-in USDA choice beef New York strip steak for $7.97 per pound with digital coupon. Limit two packages. Also this week at Safeway, 23 to 29.5-ounce boxes of Kellogg's Giant Size Cereal or buy two, get three free when you buy five. Member price. Visit Safeway.com or head in-store for more details.
Here are the facts. Okay. All right. To understand the Ludlow Massacre from the beginning, given that a lot of us don't learn this when we're in grade school, really, to the point about textbooks again, I think it's fair to say that we need to understand just how crazy the age of rail was.
And how much iron and coal and raw materials you need to both create a giant railway and then maintain it.
And just the absolute cutthroat competition of it all, the space race of it all, kind of, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's crazy to think that a lot of this was private industry. It wasn't the United States of America coming through and saying, we're going to build all these specific railways. It was individuals with like corporations, companies that they created themselves, who are attempting to make these smaller systems of rail that then all end up getting connected at some point.
Yeah. And to be clear, the US government was at every step subsidizing
corporations
in ways that, because they wanted it to happen too. So they're, what they're doing is, while they're not creating Uncle Sam's transcontinental, definitely only government workers railway system, what they are doing is giving a lot of largesse from taxpayers. They are modifying immigration policy specifically
to their benefit
for what we would call slave labor or conscripted labor today. And they're on the same team. They're just by hook or by crook going to get this stuff done. And so they like, a lot of the hand is hidden here, but to be clear, the US is completely on board with this stuff, up to and including exercising their military might in support of these private, because this is the last point I want to make on this. There is separation of church and state in the United States, but this is an excellent example of why the Constitution has always conveniently ignored the danger of not separating business and state.
Yes.
Well, I guess it's occurred to me before, but, you know, America has this history of being this like welcoming immigrants with open arms and all of that stuff and this melting pot kind of country. But there's part of me that's always thought that that was really only to the benefit of industry when it was convenient, you know? Like to allow all of these folks to come into the country so that they could kind of be exploited. Is that too cynical an outlook?
No, I mean, obviously I'm biased towards cynicism as well, but I would say with your point there, Noel, it's kind of as though someone makes it across one of these two vast oceans at the time, and they get to the United States and they say, oh, this is a land of opportunity. I'm so glad I could be here. I'm here to pursue my fortune and my dreams. And then someone says, that's great, man. As long as your fortune that you're pursuing is backbreaking work in a mine or on a railroad, and don't worry about complaining because we'll just kill you.
Yeah. Oh, dude, that, and this is the point I want to make. I think the buffer of a private organization like that is so important when it comes to a massive government attempt to build a transcontinental railway kind of thing, right? Where you've got a buffer of a private company, where nowadays it's the same kind of deal. If you've got a separate company that is, let's say, hiring the specific people who are doing the work, if those workers get hurt, if something goes wrong there, it's the company that then is beholden to that thing. It is not the government's fault. It is not even perhaps the parent company's fault. It is the contracting organization, right? And when you've got a mass influx of, say, Chinese laborers who are literally giving their lives to both the rail, or Greek workers who come in who are giving their lives to the coal mine, it becomes a whole different thing that isn't looked at as at the government. It is whoever the, I was going to say oligarch, but that's not the right term. Whoever the, you know, heads of these giant capital systems are.
The tycoons. And then it becomes a war for public opinion, right?
Yes. Because
Congress gets touched pretty easily then, as of now. No offense to members of Congress listening tonight, but you know what. You know what we mean.
A little offense, perhaps.
No, an observation.
You know what you did.
An observation.
Fair. Right? You know what you're about to do.
You know what you're doing right now. But we can all, so the story one of the pivotal moments is in our origin story is in the mid to late 1800s. There are a bunch of survey teams who were trying to figure out the routes for these ostensibly private railways. One of these survey teams is led by a guy named William Jackson Palmer. And in 1867, they're mapping out potential routes for a thing called the Kansas Pacific Railway. You get it. It's in the name. Kansas Pacific. Mm-hmm. That's where they're headed.
Like, are we going to go around these mountains or through them mountains?
The only way out is through.
And so Willie and his buddies are, you know, snoop-a-dooping around, and then,
I like that. I'm sorry, that made me chuckle.
With some dynamite every once in a while.
Yeah. just as a treat every so often.
Full of dollars, you know.
Yeah. Cue the NEO. And they realize that the Rocky Mountains in this area, in Colorado and specifically, there's this agglomeration of veins of coal that are quite close to the surface, to the point where you don't need, at this juncture, a ton of infrastructure. You can actually just
pull out of the ground with your hands.
I mean, maybe a shovel, but yeah, it's that close.
You're right. Like, dig a small amount down to really get access to a ton. Like, we're talking game-changing amounts of coal.
Yeah, this could, it proliferates at such a high rate in this area of the mountains that you could be a mom and pop operation. And this is a dream find. Vague wording aside, this is a gold mine. If you're building a railroad, your fuel source is right there. You know what I mean? You don't have to ship it from the other mines out on the East Coast. You can just build a depot here, get the coal you need from, you know, leaving from the East Coast, and then stop over here wherever you want to build it, and then just have someone throw coal in the back of the machine, and boom, boom, boom.
Are you guys ever like mystified by the fact that there is still coal to be mined? You know, it being a finite resource, and just like how long we've been pulling that stuff out of the ground, and that there's still coal to be had. I find that incredibly mystifying.
I don't think our brains are meant to comprehend some of that stuff. Kind of like how many chickens are born and produced and grown into
factory
fully
farm.
Fledged chicken and then killed and then eaten at, you know, chicken restaurants.
It's like a mind-boggling number. Yeah.
You can kind of think about it, but the numbers just don't make sense when you even hear them, or you looked at a picture. You'd just be like, there's no way that's real.
The human mind isn't there for the scale.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, one of the easiest ways to maybe not sense the scale itself, but to sense the discrepancy of that, to your earlier point, Noel, is to imagine how many years is 1 billion seconds. If you counted to 1 billion every second, how long would it take you to get to a billion? The answer is almost 32 years.
Yeah, my brain was already hurting just even scratching the surface of that thought. Yeah.
Oh, I could have done that easy by now.
I was counting on my fingers.
Yeah. The key is to not stop counting.
Exactly. Ever. I always go back to video game references, you guys, but I'm thinking about this coal discovery there in that specific place where they're trying to build the rail. As in StarCraft, when you find like the resources exactly where you need them to be to make a second base to attack your enemy. I don't know why I'm thinking about that, but you're just like, oh man, there's so many resources right here. This is the perfect spot.
I think of Sid Meier's Civilization series,
and I think of No Man's Sky, which is another mega resource extraction. Is that kind of like the point of the whole game? It's pretty fun. I enjoy that stuff.
In Civilization, one of the settings, and this is for hopefully not just, you know, 12 people in the audience, but in Civilization, one of the settings determines your resources in your opening moves of the game. And a huge part of it is, to that point, positioning structures near valuable resources. And Sid Meier didn't make up Civilization as a concept. He just made a game about Civilization.
It's been around. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sorry, Sid. It's been done. No, I'm kidding. It's a great game, but the great game.
It's the great game.
Yeah. But like we're saying, this is an absolute windfall. this is a watershed moment for the expansion of rail, because now we have this new yet untapped to them resource. And so over the next few decades, from what we say the late 1860s to the early 1900s, coal mining explodes in Colorado, sometimes literally, unfortunately. But by 1910, the coal mining industry alone is employing 10% of the people in Colorado.
That's huge.
It was a smaller population at the time.
Yeah. Right. But it really is, as you said, akin to the gold rush kind of thing, where so many people flocked out there because there's opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and imagine, you know, you're, let's see, imagine you've emigrated from Greece or Italy, right? Or maybe somewhere over in the Pacific, and you're going to find yourself in a coastal city that's often very crowded. It's often very competitive, and your opportunities may be limited depending on your connections.
Because so you came by ship, right? That's just important. Like, you're right there, you're stuck there, kind of.
Yeah, no one flew there at this time that we know of, right? Yeah. And there were people crossing land borders, right? Canada and Mexico in particular, obviously. But for a lot of folks who land in the United States, given that promise of opportunity, they find that it's incredibly difficult to make it in a New York, for instance, yeah. Right? So there's this clarion call. Things like the romanticism of the Wild West is still very much in play. So a lot of times people are going to see maybe a flyer, or they'll hear from a friend of a friend about an amazing opportunity several states, hundreds of miles away. And so it's no surprise that people came from all around the U.S. and the world to Colorado to work in these mines, you know, to maybe, to the point about the gold rush, maybe even stake a claim if possible. Unfortunately, a lot of folks were late to the game. And by the time they got there to Colorado in specific, there weren't mom and pop outfits. Yep. There were families living in company towns, scared to death of angering huge corporate leviathans.
Oh yeah. And just to get that, or just to get the scale of that trip that we're talking about, let's say New York, right? If they came in through New York, you're going 1700, 1800 miles to get to your opportunity. The stuff we've learned over the past, I don't even know how many episodes, where we've been talking about these schemes where we'll pay for your travel to get to that opportunity kind of thing. And then not necessarily put you in indentured servitude, but you will owe us.
Well, it's also this notion that like the companies are out to provide opportunity. Like that's the sort of, you know, PR line that is sold to these folks making this trek on their own steam, only to arrive and realize that the ground floor has been occupied for a long time. Yeah. And they are now beholden to something much bigger than they could have ever imagined.
Shout out to Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath.
Oh, right? Hugely. Yeah. That's the book that really hipped me to this whole struggle and this whole structure, you know?
Yeah.
And we were talking a little bit about Woody Guthrie off air, which we'll get to a little later. Matt, you found a great quote. But there's a film called Bound for Glory that is about Woody Guthrie's story, the folk singer, and his involvement in labor. And it shows this exact kind of Grapes of Wrath type situation where there are these almost like camps of folks that are waiting for work. And it's just not coming. And now they're all there and they've abandoned their homes and they've got furniture strapped to their jalopies. And now there is no work for them. Or if there is, it is absolutely indentured servitude.
I would say, though, to be completely objective, those big companies are looking for opportunity, just not for the people they're exploiting.
That's right.
It's in the dirt. It's in the rocks. Yeah. We got to pull it out.
They're looking for their shareholder.
Yeah. Right? But just to really just keep ourselves in the minds of, let's say, a head of household who's brought their entire family out there for this opportunity. Once you're there, what are you going to, and what if that opportunity, what if it dries up? Are you going to take your entire family back that 1800 miles to try and go somewhere else? Are you going to just move 200 miles somewhere
else? You're homeless at this point. You're basically nomads.
It's not possible. Also, a lot of people who had their own means of transport at this time ended up selling that means of transport upon arrival because they needed the capital to exist. This is where we introduce an outfit called Colorado Fuel and Iron, biggest Ooh. Company in the area. Also one of the most Sith Lordy, known for being the harshest by far. And they were...
They're not as friendly as the name implies, Ben?
No, unfortunately. They've got nothing on Denver hugs and kisses, but add to this, they're sold. Rockefeller Sr., John D., buys a controlling stake in Colorado Fuel and Iron, and then he runs the company with an iron fist, and he eventually gives control of the company to his son, Rockefeller Jr., in a burst of creativity. And these are New York patricians. They don't go to Colorado. Yeah. They just expect the checks to come in on time, the same way kings of European empires would expect the peasants to give their tribute, even if, you know, they don't speak the same language.
Yeah. Man, we should name some buildings after this guy.
He's great. Maybe like a plaza.
Yeah.
Okay. Or maybe it should be ice skating. There should be ice skating.
Yeah. Okay.
In a big ass tree. Not all the time, but sometimes.
Yeah. And then maybe we could shoot a show that goes out live on Saturday evenings. We could shoot it in a building. Sorry.
There's a guy I like for this. We'll have to text him. He's Canadian.
I bet he knows a lot of people, though. They probably live in his building.
We'll pause here for a word from our sponsors, and we'll be back with more on the Ludlow Massacre.
It's been 30 years since the horror began.
911, what's your emergency?
Someone, he said he was going to kill me.
3 decades since our small beach community was terrorized by a serial killer.
Maybe, my dear Courtney, we're not done after all.
In the 1990s, the tourist town of Domino Beach became the hunting ground of a monster. No one was safe. No one could stop it. Police spun their wheels. Politicians spun the truth, while fear gripped us tighter with every body that was found. We thought it was over. We thought the murders had ended. But what if we were wrong?
Come back to Domino Beach, Courtney. Come home. I'll be waiting for you.
Listen to The Murder Years, Season 2, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They stroll in like regular shoppers.
Did it ever occur to you that all these crazy shoplifting stories are actually connected?
An $8 million retail theft ring.
I'm going deep undercover.
It's hard to visualize you with hair.
To connect the dots and expose this secret world.
It's 100% human trafficking.
So you can make $1,000 a day shoplifting.
Yeah.
But she's just a worker bee. I actually confront the real shoplifting queen herself.
Just wanted to see if you'd be interested in talking to me about charges and stuff.
No, I have no comment.
A mother of three, orchestrating all her crimes from a secluded hilltop mansion.
We're walking around the perimeter of the house now.
I hear the cops. Do you think we should go?
Let's roll.
We're running from the cops.
Listen to Queen of the Con Season 6, The California Girls, on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Gosh, if I was one of those California girls, I'd be sweating.
The nightmare of what happened to a family inside 999 North Rodeo Gulch Road on a perfectly ordinary afternoon, and the burning home a killer would leave behind, and the river of blood that police would find leading all the way to the deep end will stay with you for a long, long time. And it's just one of the homes waiting for you to enter on Season 3 of Murder Homes. So step inside to hear the story of a day that will always be frozen in time. Binge the full season of Murder Homes now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
April 10th, 2001, Scottsdale, Arizona. A suburban home explodes. A fireball rises into the sky. In the rubble below, police find 3 bodies, Mary Fisher and her 2 kids. But where's the dad? Where's Robert Fisher? 9 days later, a camper spots Mary's SUV in a remote forest.
There was sleet and hail and snow coming down.
Then nothing. Did Robert die in the wild? Did he escape? Is he alive today? I'm John Walczak, host of the new podcast, Missing in Arizona. You can now binge all 16 episodes. So join me as I travel the nation, tracking down clues.
If you keep asking me this, I'm going to call the police and have you removed.
Crawling into caves.
He could be buried under rockfall and you've got a skeleton leaning up against the wall.
Searching for Robert Fisher. Listen to Missing in Arizona on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Mike and Ian. We're the hosts of How to Do Everything from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Each week, we take your questions and find someone much smarter than us to answer them.
Questions like, how do you survive the Bermuda Triangle?
How do you find a date inside the Bermuda Triangle? We can't help you, but we will find someone who can.
Listen to the How to Do Everything podcast on iHeartRadio.
It's the Rockefeller like fortune has a this is a big part in that fortune, right?
Yes.
Companies like this, not just this company, but then also in Jay Gould. I didn't know much about Jay Gould until I started just going down this rabbit hole. The Gould family fortune also arises from this company because his family was one of the other major shareholders in this company.
If you want to trace oligarchical history, I think one of the best places to look is mining interest, because extracting precious resources from the ground, be they liquid or gaseous or, you know, concrete, I guess, or solids, I should say, you will find that mining is a huge, huge part of this. And there's a reason that mining fortunes don't often get talked about in the modern day. There's just so much power and indeed PR behind them.
Yep.
Shout out to Australia.
And farming families, like big industrial farming families. Mm. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, we're fun at parties. The thing is, mining, and we have people in the audience tonight who have mining backgrounds or are associated with the industry. Folks, you know well, more than most, that mining then and now in the 1800s, in the turn of the 20th century, and in the modern day, it was very dangerous work. We learned our word of the evening is colliers. Yeah. That's the technical term for coal miners.
It's a new one to me, and I'm glad to have learned it. But like you said, Ben, off mic, pretty common last name, you know. It's like one of those nominative determinism kind of situations. Maybe I just didn't realize that was a profession.
Yeah, maybe that's how they get the surname.
No, that's a thing though, right? Like, I mean, like some surnames did arise because of a legacy involvement in certain industries by those families.
Yeah, right? Goldman Sachs. Yeah.
it made me think about that magazine. I always hear about Collier's magazine, but this Collier's magazine has an apostrophe before the S. This is just without the apostrophe.
You're just a collier if you're a coal miner. And these look, let's be honest, this work sucked. You were under constant immediate threat from explosions, mine collapses, suffocation. Right. And suffocation can be very difficult to clock when you still have time to save yourself, because you suffocate due to invisible gases. That's where we get the canary in the coal mine concept, because of the lower lung capacity of the bird, it would die first. That's where that comes from.
And then get the hell out of there.
Right. And then if the bird's not Twitter pating or whatever, then it's time for us to go. Additionally, and a lot of people weren't super aware of this, or the authorities were being willfully ignorant, these colliers were at long-term risk of invisible, insidious things because of the constant exposure to dust and chemicals, the so-called black lung, right? And this is the time before x-rays. So there's not a doctor who can look at your lungs and say, hey, maybe you can work on the surface for a while.
Yeah, they just sent a canary in to just say, it's fine. The canary's back. He's okay.
Well, I mean, you kind of mentioned it, but just the work that would go into some of these giant mining facilities, because we're not talking about one entrance that goes in and everybody gets the coal from that one entrance. You're talking about teams entering a mountain essentially from various points, and often there are explosives used to make those initial I don't know, cave hole kind of the, what do you call it? The shafts. Yeah.
Cave hole. I like the cave hole.
Yes. You know, them cave holes. But there are explosions happening that are a part of this interconnected system of, you know, punched holes into this mountain. And just the collapse thing is so scary and all that other stuff. And it's not like you got walkie talkies in the early 1900s talking to each other about what's happening.
Yeah, and as things become increasingly honeycombed in the subterranean sphere, then one change in a thing that could be fine for the system you know about can be disastrous for the other interconnected things, because you know you're under the rock and there's a lot of heavy stuff above you. In addition to working in these cartoonishly unsafe conditions, the miners were working 12-hour days, 6 to 7 days a week. Like, you get a Sunday off, maybe, and they're not paid by the hour. So they're not paid, you know, X amount of dollars per those 12 hours. They're paid like piecework. You know, they're paid upon the amount of coal delivered. And in the case of the Colorado, the big companies would give you 80 cents per ton of coal that you made. However, they didn't count a ton as 2,000 pounds. They counted it as 2,200 pounds.
Oh, yeah. Just, you know, just cuz.
Just a little vigorous.
And they're also not giving you 80 cents US. They're giving you 80 cents worth of the store that you can buy from the coal company.
Load 16 tons. What do you get?
Dude.
And another part, and this is the part, oh man, this is going to be familiar to anybody who's worked in the service industry. They had other work they had to do, like their equivalent of side work. You know, you don't get paid to roll that silverware, right? To refill those ketchup bottles or those condiment bottles, but you have to do it because it's part of your job. The miners had to do a bunch of stuff that they were not paid for, laying track, clearing those escape routes in case somebody else's tunnel explodes, maintaining the tunnels, keeping the dust down, all of this stuff day in and day out they had to do. And none of it was paid because it only helped them survive to get their, you know, 2,200 pounds of coal and their 80 cents a script. And so they called all this other stuff they had to do dead work. I can't verify this, but I think they called it partially dead work because they weren't getting paid. And then partially they called it dead work because if they didn't do it, people would die.
Right. Including themselves. So you're just like, well, I might as well do it so I can continue.
Just a quick backtrack on something Ben just said too. Script being like proprietary currency that can only be used. Like, it's like Ben Bucks, right? Like, well, okay. Sorry, not to malign Ben Bucks. That's it's an economy of scale unto itself. But you would be issued, instead of pay that was universally, you know, accepted, it would be something that you literally have to spend only back with the company. That's what I owe my soul to the company store is referring to.
And not accepted in other company towns.
Right.
And this is a good modern example, just for a weird dystopian comp. We're big fans of Dave and Buster's, but what if you worked for a DMB and you had to live in, you know, an apartment complex run by DMB and they only paid you in DMB power points?
It's like with DMB too, in like, you know, certain arcades, it's almost like Sky Miles, where there's no real metric that is visible to you as to how much it's even worth. It's completely up to the discretion of the company. So they're paying you in a thing that they control the value of that you can only use to buy shit that they sell you.
Well, you just touched on something really important, because in the company's mind, you're not getting just paid in how much coal you produce. You're getting paid in not having to pay rent in the same way, because you do live on the company's dime, on the company's property, in one of their housing units that they've built thousands and thousands of for their workers, right? Mm-hmm. So the company is building that into what you are getting compensated.
Labor camps.
Your package. Yeah. No. It is a labor camp.
You're not wrong, but at the same time, you have to imagine in the minds of those tycoons, like John D. Rockefeller at the top, who's thinking, oh, well, I'm treating them fairly. I'm giving them places to live and raise their families.
What a guy. What a guy.
We built a church, and they have every other Sunday off. So it's basically Gandhi and then me.
Do you guys think people at that level have to get to a place where they really truly believe in their benevolence? Like that, yes, they have this almost God complex. They're like, I am helping the little guy. I'm doing the right thing. Mm.
You can imagine it as in, well, the thought I think that happens, and you can see it reflected in some of the reporting and interviews that some of the Rockefellers did after what we're going to talk about here.
Right.
But just this idea of, I'm going to use this because I really think this is how they thought, and I may be wrong. Correct me if I am. What else would they have if I weren't providing this for them?
Right. And emphasis on I, right? Yes. That's the issue too with the kind of, I don't want to necessarily call it malignant narcissism, but the willful ignorance again, as well as the tremendous cognitive parkour of rationalization, yes, right? This is a time when social Darwinism is still very, very big, right? People do believe in the American aristocracy, that some people by the lottery of birth are fundamentally in some way superior. I do think it's important here to raise the specter of the controversial Dunbar's number, which argues that after a certain amount of people, to our idea of scale, the human brain no longer thinks of folks as human beings with all the depth and beauty of a human soul. Instead, they think of them as functions. So to Rockefeller, these are mining things that take X amount of resources and produce Y amount of coal.
Yeah.
It's like owning a horse and paying to feed and water said horse, or, you know, maintaining machinery.
Yeah. Well, imagine a Rockefeller going down, like traveling at some point down to the mining operation and seeing all of the people standing before him. Those are not individual people. Those are his army of folks who bring him more capital.
I bought you. Sorry. Just inside joke. Yes.
Oh, wow. God, how did I not get fired for that one? Anyway, for a grisly snapshot there, and I think we've laid out the context very well, for a grisly snapshot of what was happening, you could say this army was increasingly endangered. There was a very high rate of attrition. Indeed, it depended for a time upon a continual influx of other folks to replace the people who died. The national death rate in 1912, we're getting this from an amazing book called Killing for Coal by Thomas G. Andrews. The national death rate in the U.S. in 1912 was about 3 people per 1,000 across the United States, 3.15. In the coal mines of Colorado alone, at the very same time, the rate of death is 7.06 per 1,000 people. This means that if you work in Colorado coal mines in 1912, you have more than double the chance of dying than anyone else in the nation, including really, you know, mean cities like Boston.
It's like being cannon fodder in like an army.
Yeah. Yeah. Colorado cannon fodder.
You should have named their sports team.
The Colorado cannon fodder. Are you guys in Colorado? No, we're in Atlanta, but we are saving up for a cannon. Yeah, that'll work. Take that, Savannah Bananas.
They're delightful, apparently.
They seem like such a fun time.
They're like the Harlem Globetrotters. Like, I didn't realize that for a long time. They're like a jokey kind of trick baseball league.
Y'all are making this up, right?
No. You don't know about the Savannah Bananas?
No.
Oh, it's a thing.
It's a real thing.
They do like goofy pratfall-y. I've never seen it, but I've heard it. It's a lot. It's like what the Harlem Globetrotters would do, where they do trick shots and you know, different kind of displays. And they certainly do play, but within the games, they do all kinds of wacky shenanigans.
Well, now I've got a new thing for the old bucket list.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I'd love to go with you guys. Let's do it together.
Yeah. Let's take a trip. I have some ghosts I have to follow up with in Savannah anyway. And let's get
a lot of ghosts in Savannah.
Yeah, let's get there before that buried nuclear device off the coast finally has a bad day.
Good call.
We'll walk up to it and just tap it on the nose with a hammer like in a Looney Tunes cartoon.
Oh, gosh, great. And look, with all these factors, Savannah Bananas aside, you don't have to look far to see that there is trouble brewing on the horizon, both in Colorado and in other mining communities, and really in any labor community at this point. Between 1884 and 1912, where we got you those recent stats, mining accidents killed more than 1,700 people in Colorado. The next year, 1913, 110 guys die in mine-related accidents. This makes it to Congress, because at this time, unions begin to become part of the conversation. Before we introduce the union here, let's introduce the fact that even the patricians in Congress, many of whom are working hand in hand with corporate interests at this time, or who are compromised and may as well be employees of big corporations, they have an investigation, and they conclude the following. And keep in mind, they're speaking against their own literal bosses when they say this.
Guys, just note here as we're going into this quote, I just tried to click on that link, Ben, and I'm getting a message from archive.org that the internet archives are temporarily offline.
Oh, someone just reached out and told me that the other day. Yes.
Yeah, that happened a little while back. Unfortunately, I was writing this before they went offline, but we hope archive.org comes back soon. It's a huge deal right now.
Yeah, it was working for me. Wow. Okay. Weird. Okay.
I'm sure they're in the process of dealing with it. Maybe it's like up and down, like, you know.
Yeah.
They've been in trouble recently because they also had some protections regarding, they had a lot of books pulled that were common use.
So there's
something there's f***ing about.
Okay. Well, let's get to this quote from the State House Committee on Mines and Mining. This is the conclusion, I believe.
Colorado has good mining laws and such that ought to afford protection to the miners as to safety in the mine if they were enforced. Yet, in this state, the percentage of fatalities is larger than any other, showing there is undoubtedly something wrong in reference to the management of its coal mines. Hmm. Boom.
We took your campaign money and we appreciate it. Also, the public tide has turned. And also, while we're at it, I'm pretty sure Internet Archive was taken down by DDoS attacks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, and that happened about 48 hours ago.
Okay.
But hopefully it gets back up there. And this happened after there was a previous breach of the site that resulted in massive theft of millions of user records.
Dude.
Anyway, trouble ahead. Like we said, the coal miners at this point, you would say, okay, guys, we get it. It stinks. It's very unfair situation. It's very rough. These company towns are, by the way, designed to deny them from attaining a certain amount of economic success.
Sure.
Like the cost of things are calculated against the usual or the typical wage, such that you won't ever you might pay off your debts, but you won't ever make enough money for you to move away. They want you to stay there and powerless.
Well, and given that calculation in the favor of the company, doesn't that also mean that all this script that they're paying out and stuff, it basically is a zero sum game? Like they're essentially getting free labor because they're hiding behind the guise of this. We're subsidizing your life by giving you a place to live and feeding you, and you're paying us for the privilege. But they control all of those calculations, and they're doing it to make it where it's almost like they're not paying anything.
Yeah. And in some cases, it would be possible, just like with any other sort of dictatorial regime, it would be possible in the perimeters and the adjacent areas and the liminal spaces to trade your script for actual U.S. currency, but it would be at an egregious rate. You know what I mean? You've got Zimbabwe dollars.
Yeah, it's like trading your foreign currency at the little terminal at the airport.
At the Forex.
It's a bad idea. Did it once, not good. Don't ever do that. Pro travel tip, y'all.
But, yeah, just, you know, unless you're definitely never going back to a place, I would say just hold on to the foreign script and you know, roll the dice. See how it's going to work the next time you go.
Dude. So we're talking about them, most of the workers living on company property. Should we just get at least a bit of information about what is the police force look like in one of these company towns? Because my understanding is that they would essentially gather militias, like almost company militias, that would function as the local police to keep order as everybody is just going around town and everything.
Yeah. Goon squads, right? I mean, seriously.
Well, goon squads, but also that would be deputized.
Yes.
In times of trouble, such that they were not technically goon squads. We're going to get to a very interesting private detective agency in a little bit, but the militia, like the idea that we could rule by first by infrastructure, by rigging the game, and then second by intimidation. The third is ruling by force, by mm-hmm. physical force, harassment, intimidation, assault, and murder. These are all, and sabotage. These are all part of it. As a result of these factors, the coal miners in Colorado and abroad had no real way to air their grievances. They couldn't push for better conditions. They didn't even have the paper-thin theoretical protection that exists for labor today. Technically, under the U.S. law, it is, in most cases, not against the law to attempt to organize a union. Some groups cannot strike. Like we recently found, the post office is not allowed to strike at all. but in this case, they didn't have any of that. Your corporate boss is your local government and your local law enforcement. And so they start in secret conspiring, looking to unions for help. This is a counter conspiracy to the conspiracy of the corporations. These are obviously very smart people. They say, look, if a mine is associated with a union at this point in time in the United States in the early 1900s, they have 40% fewer fatalities because the rules are enforced. So from their perspective, it's a no-brainer to have some kind of organized labor. That's where they get with the United Mine Workers of America, UMW, and in secret, again, a conspiracy, they begin to organize. And this leads to 1913. The unionization movement goes public. I'm sure the corporation already knew there was something in the wind, but they have a list of just seven demands. And if you read them, they're pretty reasonable. You know, yeah. They're like, hey, can you just count a ton as a ton?
Yeah. Let's go through these, Ben, because that's the first one on the list, right?
Oh, that's the second one. The first one is recognizing the union as a bargaining agent.
Oh, sure. Yes. Recognize us first. But the second one is probably the most important. And we've talked about it in the early part of the show. Count a ton as a ton. Just what you said, Ben. And the other one is just how about 8-hour work days? Because that's kind of a law. So let's do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Payment for dead work, laying track, timbering, handling impurities, etc.
That's all the stuff they had to do anyway, right? They're just saying, right. Maybe compensate us for that stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then they're saying, hey, also, we think the people in charge of weighing the stuff we get paid for should be elected by us, the folks doing the work. Because there was a known problem with, in addition to, you know, that crooked thing about 2,200 pounds instead of 2,000, the company would hire these weight checkers and give them a kind of a quota of how much could be paid at the time. So the company encouraged corruption, or even more frequent, to be honest, the weight checkmen would skim a little vigorous off the top.
Of course they would.
Yep. Yeah. They also wanted the right to use their script at any store.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just to be able to buy things from any store and to choose, guess what, where they lived and who their doctors were.
So, okay, this is another thing. We'll get to this at the end. This is one that really, it bothers me personally and should bother everybody listening, unless you're already a billionaire. Right now, what they're asking for here in 1913 is freedom from a situation that you encounter today in the world of private healthcare. You have a doctor you like, but they're not in network. So imagine trying to go to a fucking grocery store and they say, you can't buy these potatoes. You're not in the grocery network.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fine. I'll just take my company bucks somewhere else.
Oh, wait, there is no
Oh, crap.
They don't take Publix pesos? This is crazy.
Dude, and let's get, I think this one is unfortunately really important. With a bullet, or let's say a whole magazine of bullets, they wanted strict enforcement of Colorado's laws, which are the mine safety stuff. They're on the books in Colorado already.
They're just not enforced.
Exactly. And they want to get rid of script.
Get
they
rid
want
of it entirely.
They want US dollars. Why not? And here is the big one, I think, guys. An end to the company guard system, which is right. The internally enforced, internally hired system of law enforcement by company employees.
But not like minors. They were just like literally a militia hired by the company to maintain order, right? So overseers. But it's overseers.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And as had already, there was other stuff in the wind here. People already knew that if things got past a certain threshold, it was well within the ability of the powers in Congress to call in actual U.S. military. Which they would do with very little hesitation. So we'd love to tell you that this is the end of the show and that these Colorado mine companies accepted these seven pretty reasonable demands. No, sorry, they rejected all of them. And in September of that year of 1913, the UMW, United Mine Workers, said, all right, our next step is a strike, and this leads to one of the bloodiest labor conflicts in U.S. history. The corporations provably conspired to, by hook or by crook, break the backs of these strikers in a literal way.
In a literal way, and very much in breaking the spirit, right, of anybody else who would even think about wanting to join up.
And when they participated in this conspiracy, when they orchestrated this conspiracy, you could argue it also, they experienced mission creep. It got further out of hand than they would ever imagine and led to a really weird era of PR. What are we talking about? We'll tell you after this ad break.
It's been 30 years since the horror began.
911, what's your emergency?
Someone, he said he was gonna kill me.
3 decades since our small beach community was terrorized by a serial killer.
Maybe, my dear Courtney, we're not done after all.
In the 1990s, the tourist town of Domino Beach became the hunting ground of a monster. No one was safe. No one could stop it. Police spun their wheels. Politicians spun the truth, while fear gripped us tighter with every body that was found. We thought it was over. We thought the murders had ended. But what if we were wrong?
Come back to Domino Beach, Courtney. Come home. I'll be waiting for you.
Listen to The Murder Years, Season 2, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They stroll in like regular shoppers.
Did it ever occur to you that all these crazy shoplifting stories are actually connected?
An $8 million retail theft ring.
I'm going deep undercover.
It's hard to visualize you with hair.
To connect the dots and expose this secret world.
It's 100% human trafficking.
So you can make $1,000 a day shoplifting.
Yeah.
But she's just a worker bee. I actually confront the real shoplifting queen herself.
Just wanted to see if you'd be interested in talking to me about charges and stuff.
No, I have no comment.
A mother of three, orchestrating all her crimes from a secluded hilltop mansion.
We're walking around the perimeter of the house now.
I hear the cops. Do you think we should go?
Let's roll.
I'm running from the cops.
Listen to Queen of the Con Season 6, The California Girls, on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Gosh, if I was one of those California girls, I'd be sweating.
The nightmare of what happened to a family inside 999 North Rodeo Gulch Road on a perfectly ordinary afternoon, and the burning home a killer would leave behind, and the river of blood that police would find leading all the way to the deep end will stay with you for a long, long time. And it's just one of the homes waiting for you to enter on Season 3 of Murder Homes. So step inside to hear the story of a day that will always be frozen in time. Binge the full season of Murder Homes now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
April 10th, 2001, Scottsdale, Arizona.
911 emergency.
A suburban home explodes. A fireball rises into the sky. In the rubble below, police find 3 bodies, Mary Fisher and her 2 kids. But where's the dad? Where's Robert Fisher? 9 days later, a camper spots Mary's SUV in a remote forest.
There was sleet and hail and snow coming down.
Then nothing. Did Robert die in the wild? Did he escape? Is he alive today? I'm John Walczak, host of the new podcast, Missing in Arizona. You can now binge all 16 episodes. So join me as I travel the nation, tracking down clues.
If you keep asking me this, I'm going to call the police and have you removed.
Crawling into caves.
He could be buried under rockfall and you've got a skeleton leaning up against the wall.
Searching for Robert Fisher. Listen to Missing in Arizona on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Mike and Ian. We're the hosts of How to Do Everything from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Each week, we take your questions and find someone much smarter than us to answer them.
Questions like, how do you survive the Bermuda Triangle?
How do you find a date inside the Bermuda Triangle? We can't help you, but we will find someone who can.
Listen to the How to Do Everything podcast on iHeartRadio.
Here's where it gets crazy. All right, this strike is huge, at least sounds huge here. We're talking about these other militias that are anti-union or strike breakers, right? Defenders of the so-called scabs. The UMW, their strike is comprised of 10,000 miners. That's a small army, and that's also not counting their families. So the number of people who are pro-union is much bigger, and they immediately focus on our earlier antagonist, Colorado Fuel and Iron Company. The practices are the worst from this company, and also the optics are the best as an enemy. Yeah. If you're a Davidian force looking for a Goliath, then you want Colorado Fuel and Iron, because their bosses also don't seem to care about the workers. They're out, they're literally living on Broadway.
Yes, 1800 miles away. And so, like, just think about the communication that has to happen there. Well, I guess Telegram is in existence at this time, right?
Sure.
Yeah, not the app, but the
yeah, but they can be sent information back and forth from whatever company offices exist out there. So there can be communication to that extent, but it is literally a couple of typed pages that end up in the hands of the controllers of the company 1800 miles away, and then another typed page of how to handle said whatever situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there, to them, again, are these actual people, or are these simply functions that when working correctly in an equation produce profit? What is the human element? The strikers meet repercussions immediately. They are evicted from these company towns once they are identified as union members, or God forbid, leaders. The leaders are actually detained pretty often. And so the striking miners, again, they don't have anywhere to go. They start building a series of tent colonies. Ludlow Colony is by far the largest of this encampment. It's quite diverse. There are people from all kinds of parts of the world, you know, and they have different ethnic backgrounds, different spiritual beliefs, but they are united in the idea of not letting this corporate power continue to oppress them. Also, Colorado winter, 1913 to 1914, terrible, terrible. No. And that you're in a tent, you're in a canvas tent.
Dude,
you will get in trouble if you steal coal from the mine to stay warm, because that's how they operate.
That's so crazy to me. And I don't think any of us in the modern era, unless you're an extreme campophile, or, you know, I don't know what the right word for that is, but, you know, you go out there and you spend winter nights camping, or, you know, in an extremely cold climate on purpose.
Shout out Alex Williams.
Oh yeah. Well, and there are many of us who enjoy that kind of thing. It's just, we have technology now that keeps us super warm, and we don't even need a fire anymore. We've got materials that can keep us good to go through those winters. But if you imagine 1913 to 14 in Colorado in that cold, I'm so flabbergasted that many people in an encampment like that survived long enough for this to even occur, what we're about to talk about.
Yeah.
And Matt, can I just applaud you on your use of flabbergasted? I don't think it's used nearly enough these days. Good job.
Well, yay.
And with this in mind, I do think it's also incredibly important to note, even now, there are people who are living in similar circumstances.
Yes.
So you have to realize it is not, then as now is not a conscious choice, and people know it's unsustainable, but they're able to get by because they're supporting each other.
And shout out to the podcast Big Sugar by Celeste Headley. We had Celeste on the show a while back, and it's a total company town situation with a lot of those massive sugar companies with these, you know, workers that live at the behest of the company on company property in these bunks. It's the more things change, the more they stay the same. To be a little cliche.
And again, we have to remember that for decades, in the case of Ludlow, Colorado, in this colony, people have been flocking to this area in search for that opportunity, right? That American dream that is sold so hard to you. And despite their demographic differences, you know, the inevitable bouts of infighting, they were unanimous in their mission. And they said, if we stick together, we can make a difference. There are more of us than there are of them, them being the patricians, but they weren't really counting the militias that would arrive.
Shout out A Bug's Life.
Well, isn't it quite tragic, you guys, that ultimately all of these human beings are out here fighting just to keep a job so that they can support the families that they're growing? Like, that is one of the primary things that's happening here.
Yes.
Like with the Oki example from Grapes of Wrath and the Great Depression, which is just on the horizon here historically. Colorado Fuel and Iron, sadly, was also internally united in opposition. And they were able to buy every politician and every member of law enforcement in the area. There's not a single story of, you know, a sheriff who didn't take the money and stood up for the people, or more importantly, you would argue, for the American Project, stood up for the rule of law. That didn't happen. In fact, Colorado Fuel and Iron hired a detective agency, Baldwin Feltz. You've heard of Pinkertons. Yes. This is sort of the Pepsi to the Coca-Cola, the Pinkertons. At first, they were just supposed to run security for the new workers who were coming in, who made a vow to not join the union. Just keep the coal mine running for the shareholder.
To basically just get them in and out of the complex, right? The mines.
Right. Without being attacked by union protesters, which would have occurred. They were to also break the strike by any means necessary. And, you know, I feel like Baldwin Feltz would be a fascinating episode of Ridiculous History, maybe stuff they want you to know, because they originally were doing good guy work. In the age of great expansion of rail in the early days, they were focusing on railroad crime, finding fugitives. They were bounty hunters, you know, and this was the era of like Red Dead Redemption 2 railroad bandits, you know, with the bandana and the like the horse is going. I hope, Dylan, can you see me doing a like a little jump riding a horse thing? Yeah. Doing that. That didn't last very long. Railroad banditry became less and less of a thing as the Americans became more settled, as they further encroached into this territory. And so Baldwin Feltz had to pivot and become private security, often for mining interest. And they got a reputation for being the fixers, if anybody had the temerity to begin a union.
Yeah. Well, and let's not forget, Emancipation Proclamation is only 1860s. So if you just think about some of the work that was done on fugitive hunting, let's
there were
say
slave catchers. Yeah.
Yeah. So you who knows where those lines are? I at least when I'm speaking right now, I don't know the full history of the Baldwin Feltz, you know, detective agency, but you can just imagine that some of that stuff's in play.
Yeah. We know that they were best known for, again, railroad banditry, but still that's why I think they were best known for stopping railroad banditry. but there were clearly cases in the previous eras where prior to the Emancipation Proclamation it was a huge industry to hunt enslaved people who were trying to escape. But this agency is founded in the 1890s.
Okay. Sorry. I'm getting my timeline wrong there. I guess what I'm trying to say is any company that is a private agency like that does essentially law enforcement work, you are taking money from somebody who probably has quite a bit of money for whatever purpose you're doing. And you can see why you would, if you're expanding, let's say, in a company like this, you would move to something like mining interests because there's going to be a more frequent cash flow and you can actually grow.
like private prisons moved to immigrant detainment. Right. And yep. They were greasing the right pockets the entire time. Look, the Baldwin Felts folks got up to some pretty nasty stuff, especially in the tent colonies, including Ludlow, but including other tent colonies, is because there were multiple. And we are going to pause here in media res. Fellow conspiracy realists, this is a rare two-parter for us, but we all very much are invested in this story, and we hope you are finding it as fascinating and disturbing as we are. So tune in just a few days when we'll be back with part two of what was the Ludlow Massacre. In the meantime, we try to be easy to find online.
That's right. You can find us at the handle Conspiracy Stuff, where we exist on Facebook, where we have our Facebook group, Here's Where It Gets Crazy, on YouTube, where we have video content galore for your enjoyment, as well as on X, FKA Twitter, on Instagram and TikTok, we're Conspiracy Stuff Show.
If you want to call us, our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. Call in and tell us anything. Give us a book recommendation. Give us a movie we need to see and think about. Anything at all. Do please give yourself a cool nickname and let us know if we can use your message on the air. If you got more to say than can fit in a 3-minute voicemail, why not instead send us a good old-fashioned email? We are
the entities that read every piece of correspondence we receive. Contacting us by email is one of the best ways for us to be able to dive into links, to dive into pictures. We all see it when it arrives. We respond. We all hear it. We can't wait to hear from you. We get so many fantastic recommendations for episodes, for future pieces of conversation. Shout out to Brock, who just let us know, get this, evidence of negative time has been found in a quantum physics experiment. No idea what that's about, but we're going to find out, because he, like hopefully you, fellow conspiracy realist, has taken us to the edge of the rabbit hole. Be well aware yet unafraid. Sometimes the void writes back, so join us here in the dark. Conspiracy at iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.